Well, still John, still compulsive eater. Hey, I was talking to somebody at the break. I carried this with me to keep my pictures in it, but it's also, I sometimes have time, if I was at a retreat, I would do it. But there's this great little pamphlet that most people don't know about in OA because it's an AA pamphlet, but it is OA approved. Anything in AA is OA approved. It's called The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. They can get, you can look an electronic copy up on the AA.org website. I just found it a really fascinating, it's just a restatement in some ways. I'll send new sponsees to read this because sometimes the big book can be a little archaic and old-time language. And he essentially just does a lot of restating. This guy, Alan M., was a therapist, and he was giving a talk to a graduating class at UCLA who were becoming substance abuse counselors, explaining AA to them in sort of modern terms, using terms. And I just found it a really fascinating pamphlet. And you can, like I said, you can get it up online. Like when I was telling somebody, one of the favorite lines in there is he's talking about spending too much time analyzing the problem versus taking care of the problem. And he says, autopsies are wonderful things. They just don't help the person on whom they're performed. I was like, which is a good in terms of analysis paralysis, you know. I'm going to answer a couple of questions. A lot of these questions have to do with my meditation stuff, which I'm going to hopefully get to if I speed it up a little. But some quick questions. When you go to a restaurant, do you ask what ingredients are used in your order? For example, if you abstain from sugar, do you ask the salad dressing? I do tend to... I will ask, actually, I just, first of all, even before I got out of sugar, I didn't like sugar in my main entrees, so I would ask, like, gee, do you have, because a lot of, like, you'll get balsamic vinaigrettes. I'll tell you, I'm getting off on a topic here, but a lot of balsamic vinaigrettes actually got a lot of sugar in it, because they don't want to make it the right way. They'll use the cheap ways to just add sugar to it. I tend to use oil and vinegar personally but I do sometimes ask, and I want to, I'm a little careful of things that I don't know, and I'm not afraid to ask a waiter, what is that? The older I get, the less I have to feel embarrassed about asking about some fancy dish that I guess other people think they should know what it is and they just order it anyway. I want to know what it is so I don't feel embarrassed at all. We've got to take care of ourselves. If you're allergic to peanuts, you ask, is there peanuts in it? If you're diabetic, you got to make sure, there's nothing wrong. One of the things I do a lot of times when I get into food or somebody's asking me about my food, I just say I'm allergic. It does wonders. You don't have to say I'm in a program, you say I'm allergic. Shuts them right up. If they ask, you say what happens if you do? I break out in fat. I have a sponsee who's working the 12 steps by answering the questions in the OA workbook. Do you feel that they need to read what they've written, except in the fourth step, or is it enough to talk about what they've written? I guess that's a jump ball. A lot of times it does help to talk, because then you can sometimes pull out other things. Now, if you just don't have the time and you don't want to do it, I guess I can't force you to, but I would say probably it would be a good thing to read. Because again, you may get more out of it, or you may hear something that they've been glossing over. One of the things I deal with sponsoring is I joke that a good sponsor has to have an excellent BS detector. And it isn't that I've ever had a sponsee lie outright to me. There's more like overt omissions, and sometimes I have to go, well, when you say that, and I have to ask a little more about that. My sponsor says I'm ready to sponsor, but I am on step 7. What's your feeling about sponsoring before finishing all 12? I happen to believe it's a good idea. Remember, people were sponsoring right after, when they came to the program in the early days. It's the one place I get the most pushback from sponsees is, oh no, I'm not ready, I shouldn't be doing it. No, you can do this. I remember when Carl was my sponsor, I had a sponsee who said, I don't think I'm ready. I said, look, if you have a problem and you can't figure out what it is, call me. Just say I'll get back to you with the sponsee, call me. And if I don't have an answer, I call Carl. If Carl doesn't have an answer, he calls Jack. If Jack doesn't have an answer, he calls Terrell. If Terrell doesn't answer, he calls Natalie. And if Natalie doesn't have an answer, she calls God. And God picks up for Natalie. But it is important. It's very important to be in the chain and not be the youngest child in the group to be a part of. I can't tell you how many times as a sponsor, I have sent something to a sponsee and hung up the phone and said, okay, did you hear what you just told him to do? Remember that. You get a lot more out of sponsoring than you have any idea, but it's about giving back too. So So we'll go on some of these others. You know, somebody was asking in the break about how come the 6 and 7 steps are only have one paragraph each in the big book. And I go, well, I think part of it's they only had a couple of years of sobriety. And I don't mean that to make fun of them, but it took me years to get how important they were. And they weren't. Now, obviously, in the 12 and 12, the more it got fleshed out a lot more. But, you know, in the beginning, I think it sort of was where I was when I had that amount of sobriety. I didn't see how important it was. On the seventh step, talks about the, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. For me, that was, the concept of humbly. I tended to see humbly as humiliation or trying to be humble. And then what's that mean? I'm like, Gandhi or, some monk. And I heard somebody say once that humility is just having an objective view of yourself and where you are in the world. Not at the top, not at the bottom, just, right there. And that's when I think about, I don't have to act like Gandhi. Back when I lived back east for a while, I was, I lost all the weight and I could talk reasonably well. And I people thought I was, much more recovered than I was. I actually had very little recovery. But I joked, I remember that commercial they used to run? I'm not a doctor, but I play one on television. Yeah. Well, I used to say, back in the east, I wasn't an old timer, but I played one at meetings, and I'd walk around and I was like the OA phrase machine. Well, you should pray on that. And I didn't know anything, And the longer I'm around program, I love being around these people who've got 30 years and they get up and they bust themselves. They just absolutely bust themselves for, because they're human. They're not trying to be this thing. And that's because they have a good view of themselves in the world. What it comes down to is I'm just another bozo on the bus, meaning, I'm not any different. And again, because I'm not different, I can be teachable because I can learn from other people's mistakes, let's see. The other thing I had to recognize with my character traits is I just tend to be more sensitive than a lot of other people. And it says it in the book, we are sensitive people and it's okay today. I had when I was reasonably newly sober, I had a roommate who was my barometer of, as far as I was concerned, he was your quintessential normal person. He was your normie. Grew up with great parents, they loved him, they had a great family. And he would say things every once in a while that I would like wince over. And I realized, maybe he's normal and I'm the one who's just a little extra sensitive. It's not a bad thing, I'm fine with it. But to realize that sometimes I take things wrong that aren't meant to be, There's another, my friend Sheila talks about this, that there's a thing of thinking about character defects versus shortcomings. Obviously, in the big book, they're the same thing. And in fact, Bill was asked about this once in a Grapevine article. And he said, look, I'm just, as a writer, I want to change up the words so it's not the same thing over and over. But there's a group that say that it's just a way to think about things. Character defects are the things that motivate our actions, whereas the shortcomings are the actual actions that come out of out of the defects. Some of my character defects make me do gossip. So the character defect is the fear of not being good enough or wanting to feel superior, but the gossip is the actual shortcoming. I'm just saying that's one of the things I've seen people do. The thing I got to remember about this, again, being a human being is a big part of it. And in the AA 12 and 12, it says, this does not mean we expect all character defects to be lifted out of us as the drive to drink was. A few of them may be, but most of them with most of them, we shall have to be content with patient improvement. And I've got to realize that, as much as I want, to think on, I realize that's as good as it's going to get. Somebody was mentioning golf before. I said I played golf for a while, but it was just too frustrating. Because one of the things that was frustrating about golf, I was also a really good tennis player, and you just keep getting better at tennis as you go along. But with golf, I can go down and hit a 250-yard drive right down the middle of the thing, and then go up to the next thing and go, boom, and hit it like 3 feet. And that's the most frustrating thing in the world. But I realized that what golf is about, it's about consistency. The better you get, the more of the good ones you hit versus bad ones. And it's the same, I think, with recovery, the more good days you have versus bad days. But it doesn't mean you're not going to go out and have a terrible bad day on any given day. And it's okay, and these are really ongoing things. I have to remember that part of the thing, one of the other things they talk about a lot of times is, and again, one of these these 12-step theories. Do you go through the 12 steps once and then just live in 10, 11, and 12, or do you go back and do inventories over and over? And for me, I believe in going back and doing things again because in a lot of ways, more is revealed. You know, as I get better, I go back and see things on a fourth step that I wouldn't have even thought of the first time. Well, at times, it's things I just hadn't remembered. But, you know, it's about, you know, peeling the onion, as they say. You know, you got to peel the onion, and you, as you go, you find more. And, you know, I always joke, I said, the trouble is they keep making more onion on me. No matter how much I peel, I don't seem to get down to the bottom of it. But the result of going through things is you begin to see character defects that you didn't see the first time because it didn't even dawn on you that it was a character defect. Or maybe you sort of glossed over it and rationalized, and then the longer, more recovery you have, and you lose that rationalization layer, you say, yeah, this is a problem for me. So, you know, you have to get rid of it, you know. You know, again, this is one of those ongoing things. They're not going to be permanently removed, you know. You know, versus, you know, like in that group that I spoke of, the Vision for You, they love to say recovered. You're using the old AA thing. You know, we are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless disease of mind and body. Well, I'm going to tell you, I can say it both ways. I am recovered today from eating compulsively and from drinking alcoholism. It doesn't mean, by the way, when they say recovered, it doesn't mean you can't have a relapse. It just says recovered. But am I recovered emotionally and spiritually? I wish, you know. But I realize I am recovering and that it will be the patient improvement. In the eighth step, it talks about making a list of all persons we had harmed. You know, I got to tell you, this is the number one place you want sponsor input, okay? You need sponsor feedback because I will go from writing down, you know, the ant I stepped on in the first grade, you know, like insect ant, not a relative, to glossing over really important things, you know, and I need... To do that. I remember the first time I brought my amends list, I showed it to my sponsor. I don't know how many pages. He just looks at, how long is this thing, you know? But I also have to remember, this is not a list to alleviate your guilt, you know? It is a list of amends that need to be made. And again, for me, taking it from the fourth and fifth step, the fourth step is an important way to do that, you know? And again, the other reason I need a sponsor is I'm going to want to love to exercise my option on except when to do so would injure them or others loophole, you know. And the reality is there aren't, you know, I have to be really careful. I remember saying to to my sponsor about somebody, you know, well, yeah, okay, yeah, I do owe an amends on that, but he did like 10 times as much worse stuff, and he was totally wrong in the thing he said. So if I make amends to him, I'm going to validate that he was right about that thing he's totally wrong on. And my sponsor's like, nah. You're doing yours, don't worry about his, you know. And it's so important, you know. You know, one of the things I also got taught was, you know, you can also break those things down into, amends I'm willing to make, amends I'm not willing to make yet, and the no way in hell amends, right? Well, what you do is you start making the amends you're willing to make, and as you're doing them, all of a sudden, the ones from the two groups start popping up into the one group, and maybe a couple of the threes pop up in the twos, and as you, again, part of that great process is you see the advantages of doing it later by looking backwards. You realize how good this is. And, for me, that's a big part of getting that, you know. Then, part of that is, am I able to go do this with a clear head and an open heart? Because if I'm not, you know, then I'm going to be like, you know, I don't want to go up and make amends and go, well, this is what I did and this is why I was wrong. And, you know, wait for them to say all these things. I can't do it that way. I have to go into that. And in the ninth step, the idea of making direct amends to such people, you know, that's, you know, not easy either, you know, to have to go and say to somebody, because chances are, you know, there were some real feelings about things. And you know, I got taught early on that faith, the order of things is whenever possible, face to face, you know, yeah. And as long as you can, and even if it means delaying it, it's better than telephone. Only then maybe a telephone and way below that email, you know, and certainly don't text an amends, you know. But the point being is really this is about doing that and getting it out there for the person. And you know, And one of my favorite stories is a lady in program in the Valley who has been around since 1960. She was the first treasurer of OA. And she tells this story about when she went to make amends. She was, in addition to being a compulsive eater, she was a compulsive shoplifter. And she used to shoplift from the May Company, which is down in L.A. And she decided that she had to go do this now. She had to go make amends. And she left a note for her husband on the table in the Valley saying, if I'm not here when you get home and you're reading this, I'm in jail. Come bail me out. And she drove over the hill and showed up at the May Company and explained her situation. Of course, baffled the hell out of them because they didn't know what to do. They said, well, geez, we've had this kind of thing before, but usually either somebody sends us a check. And so they worked out something where she gave something to them or donated to charity. But the point is, willing to go to any lengths there, right? Willing to say, I could go to jail, but I want my recovery more than I'm going to worry about that kind of thing. And the reality is, I don't know how how many people have done amends. People love to be magnanimous for the most part. People want to be forgiving, and especially if you go at it and you do it with an open heart. I also tell sponsees, just go do it and don't talk about where it comes from. Because to me, it's like, well, you know, I'm in a 12-step program, so I have to make amends. So I'm making amends to you. And they're going to be like, well, what? If you weren't in program, you'd still be going, you know. And so to just go make amends and to try and do it. And again, without expecting anything back. And you know what? You know, sometimes it doesn't go that well. I remember when I was reasonably new in program and in that clubhouse I used to hang out in. We had this guy, Stan, who got sober about the same time I did. And he was a house painter. And Stan had worked with his best buddy since high school, who was like the contractor or the head of the painting thing for I don't know how long. And a couple of months before he got sober, he was a raging drunk and anger and all that. He just quit on his boss, his friend, and just left the guy in a terrible lurch, and it almost cost him his business and all that. And he would show up at the meeting. He kept talking about it over and over. He said, I got to go make amends because I, you know, really did this guy wrong, and I want to make amends. And he kept talking about it. So one day he comes into this lunch meeting, and he's like whistling, and he's all happy. And I said, oh, what's that going on? He said, oh, I made that amends that I, you know, to my boss, you know, guy. And I said, wow, you're very happy. I guess it went well. He says, no, you know, I told him what I told him, and he told me to go F myself, and he hung the phone up. And I said, well, why are you so happy? And he says, well, because it's his problem now, you know. And it's real. It's like he didn't do it just to alleviate his guilt. He truly felt bad. He truly did the best he could. And it wasn't accepted, but he did as best as he could. He cleaned up his side of the street. He didn't, you know, I'm sure that guy had things he did to him. He didn't try to do any of that. He just tried to get it out, you know, and to do it with as best as he can. And what you'll find, like I said, is you'll find things get better and you are able to work your way up to getting rid of some of the tough ones. And, you know, some of these you can't make. You have to, you know, that are gone. You just have to, you know, people who are dead, you know, and all you can do is just, you know, I don't know, go to a grave if you can and, you know, sort of say it out loud or try your best and then move on. You know, and part of this is I have to remember the word is amends. You know, we make amends, we don't make apologies. And the difference is amend means to change. You know, you have to want to change and be better, you know. And, it, you know, this is true in, like, you look at, like, you know, the end of The Godfather where he's going in and he's doing confession in communion and meanwhile he's having people shot. And I remember having a friend who was a priest, you know, in the Catholic Church where they have confession. He says, you know, it doesn't work that way. You know, you can't do something and then go out and continue to do it and think it's okay, you know. And it's the same with, you know, making amends. If I'm really making amends, I'm trying to change my behavior and not do it again. Doesn't mean we won't inadvertently do it, but we're trying better, you know. And again, you know, all you know, this should start to come easily to you. If for no other reason than you've seen the benefits that have come with the steps before it. And again, those other steps you've looked backwards and seen they're better, and the trust that this will be the same thing with 8 and 9, that you'll look back and realize how much better you are and how much guilt and stuff you've gotten out of your system. And you know, again, you know, it becomes about from this day forward, how do I live life in 10, 11, and 12? And that's an important thing, you know. You know, and in 10, we talk about, you know, a continued to take personal inventory. I remember saying early on, this is the one I think I've done the best since the earliest. I'm really, see, in my family, it was dangerous to admit, you know, admit you're wrong. You know, you were a target, but And so when I was early on, I would just make all these convoluted things of why I was always right. Well, you got to understand, I did this because you did this, and because of that, and that's why I was acting like an asshole. No, I was acting like an asshole. And the thing is I found such wonderful freedom in being able to have something that I did bad and just go, you know what, I screwed up, I'm sorry, and mean it, you know, and then move on. It's just like, it's a wonderful way to get it out, you know. The only thing is, I really wish I didn't have to do it so much. That's the other thing. You know, the AA 12 and 12, it talks about the concept of restraint of pen and tongue. This is one of my worst, and in fact, I want to amend it and have it say, restraint of pen and tongue and send button. You know, because that's the one that gets me, because it's instantaneous sometimes. And you know, my old therapist, who was also a techno geek like I was, explained to me one day that all these things like email and posting on websites and Facebook and all that, the problem with those things is that they're methods of communication that don't afford us other things that we have. Like, you're watching me now, you see my body language, you hear the inflection of my voice. I am imparting through these things my emotions to you. You are getting my emotions. The trouble with those sterile things, like emails and things like that, is that the emotion of the reader is folded into them, as opposed to the writer. It explains why sometimes I will write a very innocuous thing and get totally flamed back, or I will misread something and fire out. So I've really tried, especially with things like that, to not do that so quickly. You know, one of my favorite stories is the President Harry Truman. He was very volatile. He would get very angry and stuff. And what he learned to do is, when he got really angry at something or some person, whether it's somebody in Congress or a press person, or he sat down and wrote these letters. Dear so-and-so, you dirty son of a... And you write it, and he finish it, and he take it and put it in his desk. And it was the act of getting that stuff out that allowed him to move on. And the funny story on that is, you know, after he left office, they opened the Truman Library in Independence, and they brought the desk to Independence. Those letters were in the desk, and they later told him out. And you can actually, I have the book at home that is based on, but, you know, again, it's the idea of getting them out. So now if I get some kind of an email, I will go write the whole thing up, and then I'll save it to a draft. And say, if this is valid, it'll be valid tomorrow morning. And when I go back and read it, 90% of the time I either rewrite it severely, or I will delete it altogether. Because, you know, the idea of communication, you want to get something across. And if you just hit somebody with a broadside, essentially the wall goes up, the words are bouncing off their heads, you know. Whereas if you can say something in a better way, you may achieve what you want. But, you know, that took a long time for me to get. But, you know, and then, you know, when what time is it? I just want to see. You know, people say in the big book, well, there aren't a lot of actual instructions in the big book. But you know what? There really are on this and on the 11th step on page 86 in the big book. Because on this, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we, and again, this is from before, were you resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves that we should have discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all, etc.? You know, I won't read the whole thing. Careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. That would diminish our usefulness to others. After we making our review, ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. And again, you know, some of this has a slight, you know, older tone to it that I'm not keen on, but I'll, you know, accept. You know, but for me, I think it's a valid thing. For me, I tend to, you know, try to, as I'm going to bed, just think about how the day went, what could I have done better? You know, what things haven't I done right? What could, you know, I've done? Some people will sit down and write a formal 10-step every night. I know some people, and I'm terrible at this, do an AEIOU inventory, right? Does anybody remember? I had it written down at one point. Yeah.
A, was I abstinent today? E, did I exercise? I,
myself, right?
Did I do something for myself today? O, did I do something for others? U, I want to uncover my feelings. And sometimes Y, did I do something that made me go, yippee!
Yeah, that's it. Okay. Thanks. I needed the help on that. But, you know, it's a valid thing to try and take a look at it. You know, we're constructively review the day, not pull out the bullwhip and start, you know, thrashing ourselves. And then the 11th step, you know, sought through prayer and meditation to, you know, improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, again, this is where the paragraph right after that last one, it does talk about on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours a day. We consider our plans for the day. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I know for me, I was taught, you know, early on that, you know, if I want to be leading a 12-step life, I need to get up and start my day that way. I need to somehow do that, you know, and I know when I try and do that, you know, my old AA sponsor used to say, here's what you do, because I said, oh God, I have such trouble, I'm an A-type personality, meditation is not my strong suit. And he said, okay, here's what you do. You get up every morning and you don't turn on the TV and you don't turn on the computer. Go make yourself a cup of tea or coffee and just spend a little time. And I found that sort of works. And I started trying to read like one of the books every day, the Four Today or one of the other books, just to, you know, because it's a page. It's not exactly, you know, you're not asking to read Gone with the Wind. But the idea is that every day it'll put some thought in your head that wouldn't have been there otherwise, probably. And you'll be surprised how during the day something will happen that will make you think back to that thing that you just read that you thought had nothing to do with your day and go, aha, okay, maybe I was supposed to read that, you know? And I know for me, I found the great little thing that helped with meditation. It's called the dog. I have to walk my dog every day, and now, I mean, I try and go out, and I try and think of what's going to be going on during the day, and think about it. Because, you know, again, we're sort of holding ourselves up to a slightly higher standard than the rest of the world. We're trying to lead, you know, some kind of a 12-step existence, and let's face it, the rest of the world pretty much isn't. It would be a great world. I mean, what a wonderful world if everybody was just trying to be a better person every day, instead of just sort of going blindly along the day, you know? And I find when I do that kind of thing, and I do it most of the time, my day just gets off differently. I start the day, you know, from that way, and I'm sort of in control of my day. Every once in a while, something will happen where I don't do that, and I feel like I've been thrown out of the car at 50 miles an hour, and all I'm trying to do is just to keep from going face down in the gravel, you know? And again, it's a matter of whether I take possession of the day and how I'm going to do it or I don't, you know? You know, because, yeah, like I said, prayer is easy for me, but meditation is hard. You know, that whole idea of prayer is you know, speaking to God, and then meditation is listening, you know, and the idea of being able to listen for what I'm supposed to do. And again, then I still try and bounce things off a sponsor, because, again, I can't be 100% sure. But, you know, the longer I'm around, the more I am, because it's so weird. Little things will pop into my head that I go, where the heck did that come from? It's like a thought that popped. I was saying before about all those crazy thoughts I had when I was in the relapse of you know, excuses I was making to myself. Well, I'll pray for the willingness. Well, one of the ones I remember saying one day is I'm redefining my abstinence. And the thought popped in my head, no, you've broken your abstinence. You're just redefining your honesty, you know? And it was like, ooh, you know, but that honestly popped in my head out of left field. And every once in a while, I'll have those kind of things that pop into my head. And, you know, is that the voice of God? I don't know, but I do know it means somehow listening. Maybe it's just an inner self, a higher self, a subconscious, call it what you want. But the idea of trying to start the day a little better, I think it's important, you know? You know, and again, I that whole idea now of, you know, of praying only for knowledge of His will for us. You know, again, I can't see God as Santa Claus, and this whole idea of praying for a list of my things, as opposed from me just getting in sync. You know, instead of trying to, you know, swim upstream like a salmon, I just sort of go with the stream, and you know, do the best I can to navigate through it. You know, and I love the thing, and I think it's also in Freedom from Bondage. You know, we are taught to differentiate our wants, which are never satisfied, and our needs, which are always provided for. When I think about it, it's true, you know. Whenever I get into that fear, I go, you know what, I've always been taken care of. Everything's always gone well. I remember thinking once, you know, if there was a worldwide depression tomorrow, chances are I'd have some kind of work. It wouldn't be the work I'd want to, but I'm intelligent, I'm a hard worker, you know, I can, you know, and so I might bump somebody down who will bump somebody down and somebody else will fall off the truck, but I'll probably have a job. And that sort of, you know, faith that things will be all right is important, you know. You know, Harlan says, don't tell your God how big your problems are. Tell your problems how big your God is. I always like that, you know. And the whole idea of you know, trying to, you know, one of the things that changed me in my first year in program, there's this guy, Dally, back east, and he was a piano player. He grew up in Greenwich, the town I was talking about, there, and his family was filthy rich, okay? They looked down on me, and all he wanted to do was go out and play piano in bars. But he said he was like, I remember he telling the story, he's like 12 years old and he's at home and his mother is having an argument with his father because the people next door have just gotten a second Rolls Royce and they only had one. And he said, you know, I remember being 12 years old knowing that anybody that needed a second Rolls Royce to be happy was never going to be happy. And the light bulb went off in me. How about, I have that tendency. If I get this, I'll be happy. If I get that. And it really hit me that, you know what, that has to get divorced. You know, there's a big line that Lincoln said about, I think it's in Just for Today readings that they sometimes read, that, you know, a person's as happy as they make up their mind to be. And the reality is true, you know. And I realize, like, you know, as long as I'm going to put, you know, I'm going to put parameters on that, you know, I'm just never going to, you know, I'll always move the goalpost. I'll always move the goalpost to the next thing. I get this, now I want that. Now I got that. You know, also, when it comes to having a belief in a higher power, I came into that so rapidly atheist, you know, which, of course, to me, the longer I think about it, I have trouble with pure atheism, because atheism says I absolutely believe there is no thing. And to me, that's as much as I absolutely believe there is. I mean, I think most of us go, geez, I hope there's this, I hope there's that. But no, I don't know for sure. But I came in that way because my brain was on this pedestal. You know, man's the best thing, and I'm one of the smartest people. So, you know, I was, for all intents and purposes, thinking I was God, I think. And you know what? I'm not, and we're not. You know, one of the first retreats I ever did was up in Portland, and so I got in early and I drove up to Mount St. Helens. I don't know if anybody's ever been there. But you come off the I-5 highway, and you got to drive about 25 miles in to get to it. And at about 10, 15 miles in, you start hitting the trees that are blown over. And you know you're 10 or 15 miles or something like that. I forget how long. It may not be that much. And you get there, and then you see all these trees blown, and you realize, God, just think of that. We're little ants on this thing, aren't we? You know, you know. You constantly read about, you know, scuba divers or snorkelers off the coast right here in the Channel Islands. You know, getting eaten. We're not even at the top of the food chain, folks. You know, you ever think about that? I've led this retreat down in San Diego up in Julian, and they have this announcement they make at the beginning of the thing saying, remember to bring your flashlights to the cabins after the thing because there are bears out here. And I'm like, wouldn't it be ironic to get compulsively overeaten at an away retreat? Yeah. Yeah. But you know, and again, I think it's the most important thing, the only praying only for knowledge, you know. And you know, I don't pray for things anymore because I don't know what I need. You know, I remember somebody once saying I was praying for a bicycle and God sent me a Lexus, and I'm saying, get that Lexus out of the way, I want to see my bicycle, you know, because I don't realize. And sometimes I'm praying for something, I gotta realize, think about, maybe this is the answer, you know. And you know, what's it, God's, you know, yes, no, and wait, you know. So maybe it's either wait or no, even. And I got to be willing to accept that, you know. You know, and no matter what kind of belief you have, you know, whether it's a, you know, Judeo-Christian God, maybe an Eastern God within, you know, it's about calming that void, that craziness inside. That's what I've always wanted, you know. Yeah, so, and I've also heard the concept of meditation being focused thought. I sort of like that, the idea of focused thought. It doesn't have to mean, you know, just totally clearing your mind. And on step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, one of the things I say about the 12th step is I really think it's two steps, but they didn't want to have 13 steps. Let's face it, that's like bad juju, right? You know, but if you think about it, they really are, you know, they are two different steps, you know. You know, as and then the I remember, I don't remember if it was Doris or somebody from the program who said the most misunderstood or misread step is this one, because it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Most people read it and say a result of these steps, the result. And remember them saying, you know, this isn't just being, you know, a pain in the ass, you know, a parsing of words. It's about the idea that the main result is a spiritual awakening from which all else then comes. And I think it's true, you know, that the idea of once we've had a spiritual awakening, a lot of things change in us, you know. For me, a lot of it was, you know, getting out of ourselves, to think of somebody else instead of ourselves, you know. If you think about it, really, being selfish is inbred in us, you know. You think about the thousands and millions of years of evolution, we are the descendants, very possibly, of people who threw their best friend in front of the saber-toothed tiger so that they lived, you know? And this is what animals do. They're taught to do that. And so we have to somehow rise above that somehow. And that means, you know, whether you want to call it God or a higher power or a higher thought, you know, you read stories of Marines in battle jumping on a hand grenade to save their buddies. That's not animal behavior. That is a, you know, behavior above them and being willing to do that. And that's where I think we separate ourselves from the animal kingdom. We have a lot of these choices to make, and I think that's one of them, you know. You know, and just the idea of doing things for others and knowing it'll come back to you. You know, when I was a comedian, one of the things I did a lot was improv. And one of the things they teach you in improv is don't sit there and worry about getting the laugh and getting the joke. Worry about helping the other person get the laugh. Because if you do that, and if everybody does that, we're all going to do better, because we'll all end up better. And it's sort of the same. If we all were working toward helping the other person, it would all end up coming around. And to this day, I'm a big believer in karma, you know, just that everything, you know, happens this way. And then in terms of carrying the message to others, I mean, I really do believe in this whole idea of service. If Dr. Bob and Bill hadn't, you know, gotten together and done a lot of work, and you know, in the early days of both of these programs, there was a lot of work. I talked to Roseanne at length about how much work was involved in those first early years of getting this thing off the ground. You know, yes, at some point it grabbed its own momentum, but there was thousands and thousands of hours. And if that hadn't been there, you know, if this was 100 years ago, I'd be dead for 20 years probably. You know, because there was no AA, there was no OA, there wouldn't have been anything. And so the fact that there is, and I was here at this time, means I got to be willing to give some of this back. You know, and you know, when I see a meeting where, you know, one person puts their hands up as a sponsor or you know, ask at a meeting, you know, for somebody. You usually get somebody who'll be willing to be a secretary, right? But then everything else, forget it, you know? And, you know, this is, if it's not here, you know, if I don't do this for others, you know, it was there for me. How can I expect that to be? You know, and again, that's one of those things I had to learn, you know, at the end of why it was so important, you know? But you know, or one of the things we talk about is if you're having a problem, get out of yourself. You know, trust God, clean house, help another person. You know, let's see, what did I see? The funny thing is, I write these notes down, but then I end up talking about them earlier, so I have to learn to jump over them. You know, but and then you know, just let me just say something about. Okay, this is slightly critical. It's not meant to be, but it is. We are doing a lousy job in OA of sponsorship chain. You know, people come in, they spend thousands of dollars on commercials and public outreach at all different levels. And then newcomers come in and say, and then somebody says, how available sponsors raise their hands, and it's like crickets, you know. Or there's one or two sponsors and they've got eight people because nobody else wants the sponsor. This has to continue. And I don't think you have to have done all the steps to be able to reach out and help somebody else. But it's important, and that chain is being broken. And I would say, if you are a sponsor, you need to emphasize to your sponsees that they need to to be doing it, and that they need to tell their sponsees that they have to sponsor, and their sponsees have to tell youth sponsees, or else this is just not going to continue, because it's just not going to stay around. I'll also talk just quickly about the 12-step within. You know, I was going through my major relapse. I gained 50, 60 pounds in front of people. Nobody ever said a word to me. You know, when I lost weight, oh, yeah, you're looking good. Well, you know, we need to be doing that. And it's hard for us to reach out to people who are relapsing in program, but we need to, because this is part of helping others. If we can't do it, who can? Now, we have so much shame when it comes to stuff like that. We don't want to do that. But yet, we got to help. You know, I mean, you think about if you had a best friend and you're talking to her, and when she turns around, there's a really nasty, ugly mole that's right in the back of her neck that she could never see herself. Wouldn't you go say something to help them? Well, that's what we have to find a way to do. It can be said nicely. I you know, and a lot of it has to do, unfortunately, with weight, because that's, you know, one of the things. I always, when people say it's not about the weight, I say, yeah, it's not about the weight in OA any more than it's about your breath in AA. And people will look at it and say, well, it's not about your breath in AA until you come up to me with booze on your breath and tell me you have 20 years of sobriety. You know, it's like, well, the weight is the booze on our breath, you know. And if somebody, and if I came in with booze in my breath, nobody would go up and go, what the hell are you doing, you horrible person? They come up and go, is there anything I can do to help? Is there anything, do you have anything you want to talk about or anything like that? And see if, you know, things open up, you know. And again, you know, that's all we can do. I can tell you that I've tried to reach out to people. The other thing that happens here is you all of a sudden start to see holes in the line, to use a military term. You know, nobody, very rarely would somebody ever get up at me and go, that's it, I'm leaving OA, and walk out the door. Just you turn around and go, gee, I haven't seen Joe in a couple months. Where is he? And what I'll try and do is just pick up the phone and make a call. And I just call, hey, how you doing? Is everything okay? You know. And that's it. I'll try and say, I'm there in case you want to talk. I mean, I remember doing that with Murray, who died. You know, I'm every couple months, just call him up. I don't want to do it too much, because then you get into this problem of, you know, you could end up polluting the waters of him coming back and thinking, oh my God, they're coming after me. But to try and do that. And when it comes to carrying 12-step out in the real world, that's hard too, because, you know, I see people every day. I want to go, you know, bang them over the head like a caveman and drag them in by their hair in the program, but you can't do that, you know. You know, there's, you know, you have to be so careful with 12-step. There's a famous story in the other program of some very famous television actor who was really out of control, and his two producers, who were both in program, tried desperately to get him in, but it went so badly, it really backfired, and there was a lot of, you know, he spoke out really harshly against AA because he wasn't ready. He was a perfect example. He may never get it now because he was given such a negative view of it when he wasn't ready. You can't do it until people are ready, you know. I find one of the things I'll do is if I have a chance to meet somebody and be talking to somebody who's really overweight, I'll just somehow let it drop that I used to be 100 pounds more, and you know, oh, you should have seen me, I was 100 pounds more, and just let it go, you know. And it's like casting out a line, because I can tell you, when I was 100 pounds more and somebody mentioned that I lost 100 pounds, I want to know how they did it. Maybe the magic pill is there, you know, and I'll just do that. But after that, I won't. You know, I've had people come up to me at the retreats, oh, my brother needs this, he's three, you know, okay, you know, what can I do? And I say, nothing. You can only tell them about the program and then let it go. You know, there's one of the old AA things about, you know, my husband's continuing to drink. What can I do? He said, make him a drink. You know, meaning you can't. You just got to take care of yourself. It's sad, you know, but that's, you know, essentially what I do, you know. So, you know, and it's not up to me to say, if somebody's 400 pounds and they're happy, that's not my job to tell them otherwise. Now, I can tell you, I don't believe the average 400-pound person is happy. He may be deluding himself into thinking he's happy, but I don't think he is. And then the idea of, I'll just say one thing about this, and I get a little flack sometimes for things. So I say, one of the things you don't see as much in other 12-step programs that you see here, it's not that you don't ever see it, it's the keep coming back mantra. Keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back. And I think sometimes people take it literally that if they just keep walking through the doors, someday things will change, you know? And I can tell you, over in some of those other programs, it's a little more like, hey, there's the door. There's the door. If you need to go out and do some more field testing, you know, then it'll make you get willing to go to any lengths, you know, here's the solution. Not to say, you know, they don't, but they're not, you know, as enabling. And I think sometimes we need to do more of that. Because, you know, somebody said once, this isn't for those who want it, it's not for those who need it, it's for those who are doing, willing to do it, you know. And then the second part of 12-step, you know, practicing these principles in all our affairs, you know. I love in both the steps and the traditions, there's certain things that are left echoing at the end of them. You know, principles before personalities in traditions, and practice these principles in all our affairs. It's like, what is all of this but blah, blah, if I leave here, go out, cut off a guy in traffic, give him the finger, you know, drive along, get home, yell at my wife, you know, kick the dog or whatever. In other words, it's got to be, you know, more than that, you know. One of my favorite examples is this guy Don down in our area who's just got wonderful program. You know, he's just great. He's a, you know, I won't, you know, because we're being taped, I don't know, I said his name already, but he's a big shot. And he comes here and he just acts like anybody else. And I desperately wanted to get him. I was booking speakers for Light a Candle. And I went to him and said, Don, I want to get you. You know, I've got all these other great guys. I want to get you to speak. And he said, you know what? Light a Candle's at 5:30 on a Saturday night. I have a rule. My wife asked, could I have Saturday nights as us? And he said, and I'm sorry, I'm going to, you know. And so what can I say? You know, I'm going to say, Don, you know, come and tell us what a wonderful program you're working on. And then meanwhile, he's going to say, screw your wife, I'm going to go take care of that. No, that's practicing these principles. And you got to respect that kind of thing, you know. We have to hold ourselves to a higher standard, you know, and we have to do things differently. You know, and today I look at how I've changed in my life. You know, again, I come from New York, and I kept from this alcoholic family where everybody was, where I was told everybody's out to get you. And I went through life, I used to say, I went through life in a defensive crouch, like I'm waiting for something to happen. And you know, if you go through life like that, you it ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. You just put out a certain something. And today I don't want to do that. And you know what? I'm a lot more trusting than I used to be. And you know, I'm still a New Yorker, so I'm not, you know, crazy. But it may mean that occasionally I'll get taken advantage of. But I would rather have an occasional take and get advantage of, as opposed to living that personality I was before, being, oh my God, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. You know what? I want to live a different life. And it's hard because, like I said before, we're trying to lead a 12-step life, which means we have to, you know, sort of have a higher standard than the average people out there, you know? And the idea of recovery, I want to keep working on this. I want to keep doing that, you know, getting out of myself, you know. Let me see, just a few other things. You know, one of the other things that I came to was compassion. You know, have compassion for others, even when they're acting inappropriately toward me, you know. I'm able to see people in pain now when they do that. You know, here's the thing. When somebody says something nasty to you, it only hurts you if there's a part of you that agrees with it. You know, if I turn to somebody here and go, you got the ugliest green hair I've ever seen, you're going to laugh because you don't have green hair. But if somebody says to you, have you gained a little weight or something like that, or says something that maybe you have a little thing of, you know, and so nowadays when I get attacked, I used to always be, if I got attacked, I had to come right back at you, you know, because that's sort of the way it is. And now I can sort of say, man, maybe that person's in some pain, you know. And that's one of the things that changed, you know. I have to realize most people are just, I mean, I joke about, you know, we're all sort of just little kids in there in adult suits, you know. And we're all trying to muddle through life. We don't get those, we don't get the manuals. Nobody gets a manual. We're sort of muddling our way through life. And so when people do things, I'm getting a lot better about getting that, you know. And also having an idea on some of these things as to, gee, if somebody says something to me and it hits me and I start to overreact, maybe it's not about that thing. You know, there's a saying in program, if it's hysterical, it's historical. You know, there's a thread that goes through time sometimes that somebody says something that doesn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with something way, way back, but it causes me to have a lot of overreaction, you know. And, you know, there's a guy in program, I met him the first time, and I had an instant dislike for him. I don't know if this happened to anybody. But the thing is, I had enough self-awareness to go, there's no reason I should have an instant dislike for him. He hasn't done anything to me. He said hello. But boy, and I realized, it took a while, he looks like my father, you know, or any one of those things. And part of that is really just about, you know, it's about being willing to keep looking at me, you know, that new pair of glasses, having face toward me, and instead of always thinking about that and saying, there's something about me, you know. And I'm going to answer. Do we have any more of those Ask a Basket questions out there? I don't know if there's any more. You know, one of the things I there may or may not be any there. You know, one of the things I noticed in the last few years is when I was new. Nope. Okay. No more questions? Okay, I have a couple here I'll answer, or I'll try and answer. When I was new to program, I remember saying to a guy one day, I looked at these old-timers, and they would be talking about really tough things, and they were just going through them, you know, like it says somewhere in the book, with grace and aplomb. And I thought, God, I want to be like that someday, you know? And I remember saying to the guy, I said, you know, I just feel, and this is true, newcomers in 12-step programs, especially AA, drama all the time over everything, right? And I remember saying, God, I feel like, you know, life is like this stormy seas, and I'm like in this little boat getting thrashed all around. And I look over at these old-timers, and they're like ocean liners. They're just going right through. Nothing's bouncing them. Nothing. They're just going through. And I go, I want to be like that someday. And I realized a while back, you know, I've sort of gotten that way. But the thing that's different, now I see it from the inside out as opposed to the outside in, is that I am an ocean liner, and I am going through those waves, but I'm an ocean liner made of mesh. I'm not going through the waves. The waves are going through me. And the more I think about life, that to me is the way to go, is to just go along, let life flow, accept what happens, and change. And that's been a lot of what, you know, I learned from program. And I'm going to take some of these questions here, and we'll take it from there. And some of these I may have already answered. Do you find you need to do a 10-step daily? Do you call another? I don't call another about that. I talk to a sponsor usually, you know, when I can, once a day usually. But again, like I said, I do try and review the day at the end of the day just to see, you know, how I did. Do I always do it? No. Sometimes I just fall asleep. How did your spiritual part fit into your program? Does the spiritual part help you every day? Yeah, it does. I tend to you know, I really have got a feeling today that I'm, you know, it's almost like imbued in me now. In other words, it's there all the time. And, you know, it doesn't mean that every once in a while something doesn't jar me, you know. But especially if I know I'm going to have a problem, I can find myself getting into a little bit better of a spiritual space. You know, the problem I have sometimes is, and this probably happens to everybody, you know, so, you know, if you're going to see somebody who's like a family member who's just a pain in the neck, you can't, you know, maybe you can't stand them, maybe something. When you're going there, you can get yourself in a program mindset. It's when you figuratively turn a corner and something slaps you in the face, you know, and something happens, you could tend. I remember I remember hearing when I first came to the program and the other program, an alcoholic under pressure reverts to type, you know, meaning we'll tend to immediately want to go back to the way we used to be, but then we have to sort of try and catch ourselves, and sometimes we don't, but, you know, say, okay, wait a minute, let me deal with it. And I think as a result, that's sort of, things are different. I don't, you know, some people do, they like to pray and take moments out every day. There's, you know, specific religions that do that, you know, and I think it's more about trying to keep some kind of conscious contact, you know, and for some people, that's the way they do it. What does your 11th step look like? Do you ever miss meditation? Again, I have trouble doing meditation as such. A lot of people do. I know people who've said they started doing 5 minutes, you know, trying to do 5-minute meditation, and for them it was excruciating in the beginning, but then they kept doing it and they got better and they got better and they got better, you know, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that, trying to, you know, get a space and get an idea on things, you know. Sometimes it's just a matter of getting quiet, like it's, I said, you know, focused thought, the idea of maybe you need to think things out sometimes, and the easiest way is to sort of clear your head a little and have things happen. I you know, I do programming for a living, and I'll sometimes have a problem, and I cannot figure it out, and I'll be just banging my head against the wall, and I know I just got to walk away and go walk the dog, and I won't even be thinking about the problem, and all of a sudden, bam, it's just there. And sometimes that's the way I think it is with meditation, is that things will just come to you that way. So, and yeah, a bunch of people wrote about this, the same question, essentially. And that was one about sponsoring. And did I have that? Do you have to go to the restaurant? No, I guess I answered them all. So I think I've answered everything. You wanted me to stop at 5-0, but it looks like I did it perfectly. So let me give it back to you. Yeah.